This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Marie Sendak, artist, author, children's book illustrator, costume and set designer, turned 80 this summer. The 92nd Street Y in New York is honoring his birthday with a celebration on Monday, featuring performances, readings, and commemorations. Sendak also is being saluted through next May with a rotating exhibition featuring hundreds of his works at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia. Today we'll listen back to two of Terry's conversations with Marie Sendak, starting with this one, when she spoke with him in 1993 after the publication of his book We Are All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy. It was his first children's book that wasn't about middle-class kids. We Are All in the Dumps deals with homelessness, sickness, and hunger. It's based on two English nursery rhymes. Terry asked him to recite them.
We are all in the dumps, for diamonds or trumps. The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. The babies are bit, the moon's in a fit, and the houses are built without walls. That's the first one. Second one. Jack and Guy went out in the rye, and they found a little boy with one black eye. Come, says Jack, let's knock him on the head. No, says Guy, let's buy him some bread. You buy one loaf and I'll buy two, and we'll bring him up as other folk do.
The first rhyme that you recited,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have known what to make of it. I'd have to say, it wouldn't have made any sense to me. You want to recite it one more
sure.
time?
Well, see, there are clues in it for an illustrator. We are all in the dumps,
mm-hmm.
for diamonds or trumps. The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. The babies are bit, the moon's in a fit, and the houses are built without walls. Now, I think it's extraordinarily beautiful poetry, but it's like haiku. What does it mean? Well, I'm faced with a bridge game, diamonds or trumps. That means somewhere in this book, somebody's playing bridge. Not being a card player, that doesn't turn me on. So I had to learn how to play bridge. The moon's in a fit. You have to figure out why the moon is in a fit. What does it mean, the kittens are gone to St. Paul's? I mean, what does St. Paul's mean to American children, primarily? And then the astonishing, extraordinary line, the houses are built without walls. I mean, that's what moved me all these years to make this work for me.
So what did that come to mean to you, the houses are built without walls?
It meant, finally, kids who have no place to live. This really started back in Los Angeles, or at least one detail, and a significant one, began in Los Angeles years ago. I was working on an opera, the LA Opera, and we came home late from a rehearsal, and I was driven back to my hotel, and we passed down some very, very posh streets in Beverly Hills. Maybe it was Rodeo Drive, but I couldn't swear to it. And there, past midnight, on the street, in this posh section of town, was just a dilapidated, ruined cardboard box with two dirty, naked kids' feet sticking out. The juxtaposition was astonishing. It's as though when everybody stopped shopping and gone home, then these kids came out, or people came out, and every city is ringed around with shantytowns, homeless. We all know that. We have it in New York. We have it in every major metropolis in this country. But it astonished me to see that juxtaposition. I got interested, and I got a book on Rio de Janeiro, and discovered that there is a ringed round, well-known shantytown, kids town around the city. And kids are abandoned. Their little girls sold into prostitution. Little boys run away from being abused at home, and they make their own cities, and they're as cruel to each other as any adults can be, and their lives are very, very brief. And they live in tin cans and cardboard houses and rag huts, and I suddenly began to see what dumps is. We are all in the dumps. Back in the 60s, that, of course, meant, you know, if you're in therapy, dumps means you're in a depression, which is probably why I couldn't make anything sound out of it back then. Now dumps literally means the world. We are all in the dumps is really well describes events around the world at this point.
Marie Sendak, speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. Let's jump to a later part of his conversation with Terry. She asked him about his parents, both of whom were immigrants to America.
Now, they were from Poland?
They were from Poland, yeah.
And they fled before World War One?
Yes, they did, just before World War One. They didn't flee. My father left on a lark.
Oh, well, what was that?
He had no cause to come here. My grandfather was a rabbi. He was the youngest son, and he was obviously the spoiled younger son of my grandmother. And he actually fell in love with a young woman. And it became a little bit scandalous, and she was put on a boat and shipped off to America. And he sulked and pouted and got money out of his siblings and got on another boat to follow her here. And his family was appalled at his behavior. Because of that trivial behavior, he was the only survivor of his entire family. I mean, all of my uncles and aunts and all of the children were destroyed in concentration camps. My father's grief for his entire life was that his survival was based on such a trivial impulse. It really did cause him a lot of grief, especially when he became older.
Did your parents talk to you much about the old country?
Oh, yeah. Thank goodness. And when my father was last year of his life, paradoxically, we had a wonderful time. I took his biography down, which was wonderful. A lot of it was fantasy and a lot of it was reality, but I was...
His biography?
Yeah.
He
wrote a biography, which is not published. He did write a fairy tale, which I translated with the help of somebody else and illustrated, and that was published just before his death. But his biography is not published, and I don't intend to have it published. It's a private family chronicle. We didn't get much of my mother's life. My mother was silent about that period of her life.
I think as a lot of people from Eastern Europe who came to America were. Did they seem like aliens to you because, I don't know, did they speak more Yiddish than English?
Yes, they spoke more Yiddish. I spoke Yiddish as a child. My parents spoke English very, very late and very poorly. And we lived in a part of Brooklyn which was teeming with immigrants, either other people from Eastern Europe, Jews, or Sicilians. And I couldn't tell the difference. I mean, we lived next to the Sicilians, and I had a real, it sounds like coy conceit, but it's a fact. I had a real confusion because right across the hall from us was my best friend at one place we lived, Carmine, and his sisters and brothers and his huge mother and huge father, just across the hall. And I used to run across the hall because they had unkosher food, which is much better, much better than kosher food because it was pasta. It was great Italian cooking. And they laughed, and they drank wine, and they grabbed me, and I sat on their laps, and they had a hell of a good time. Then you come back to my house, and you have these sober cuisine and not so rambunctious family life. And I really did have a confusion that Italians were happy Jews, that they were a sect.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And that I would have a choice. That I would have a choice after my bar mitzvah to belong to either the sober sect or the happy sect.
And they went to a different synagogue where they had pasta.
Yeah, I was a dumb kid. Let me tell you. I mean, all the parents looked alike. They all wore the same dull black dresses, and you couldn't tell the difference. Not to me.
Maurice Sendak speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. We'll hear a more recent interview with Sendak after this break. This is Fresh Air. This Monday, Maurice Sendak will be honored at the 92nd Street Y to commemorate his recent 80th birthday. In 2003, Terry Gross spoke with Sendak again about his collaboration with playwright Tony Kushner. They adapted a children's opera that originally was performed by children in the Nazi concentration camp Theresienstadt. Sendak designed the sets. The opera, Brundabar, is a parable about evil. It was written in 1938 by a composer who was killed in the gas chambers. Here's the opening scene from a 1992 recording of Brundabar, recorded in Prague.
Yeah.
Terry asked Sendak why the children in the Nazi concentration camp performed the opera Brundibar.
This opera was written by Hans Krause, a very young Czech composer, and it was written for children, Jewish children, in an orphan asylum in Prague to amuse them. There was a contest who could write the prettiest opera for the children. And Krause wrote this, and everybody loved it. And at that very same point, the Nazis entered the country, and the orphanage was emptied, and the children were put into Terezin, the camp. And he was too, as was the librettist. And it became a show camp, became known as Hitler's favorite camp. He set it up in such a way and made a film of how well the Jews were being treated, and the gypsies, and the homosexuals. And this was too, because rumors were getting out that were frightful. And so he set this up to prove to the Red Cross and diplomats who were traveling the world to come by, see a show, and see how happy everybody was. And it's in the film. You see the children singing the last portion of the opera. So they all sat there. It was performed 55 times, a huge success, this little opera, which is about 45 minutes in length. That's the story. Hans Krause was murdered, too, as was the librettist, as was, well, mostly everybody in the camp. It was an elitist camp. You had Bauhaus workers there. You had artists, people teaching the children there, intellects. It was a special camp. But so, it ended the same way for all of them.
So the performances were for visiting diplomats to show off the camp?
Yeah,
Do you know if they fell for it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely, they fell for it. The streets were cleaned, trees were planted, all the children were given clean clothes, all the inmates were given clean clothes, everything was swept up, and they went and you had a pass. Quite an attractive pass, which I'd love to have an original of, but I've used as an image in the book, to get in to see Brundibar.
Tell us the story that's told in the opera that you tell in the book.
This was directly written for children, and the limitations of children. They don't have singing voices. Some of them do, but that was by accident. But mostly it's sort of like a Singspiel, which is like a Mozart opera, the Singspiel, where you talk over the music rather than actually sing. And those who could sing, sang. And the music is astonishing. He was in his 30s, so you hear Janáček and you hear Weill. And you hear Gershwin and you hear Ravel, and just like all of us young artists steal like crazy until we make ourselves up as artists, you hear all these wonderful sounds. And the story is ultra simple, so the children could follow it and produce the tale, which has to do with a little brother and sister whose mother is ill. And the doctor says unless they get milk for her, she won't last. So they go out into the world, which is, in my case, Prague, into the city proper, and please somebody save money to buy milk for mommy, and nobody will. And in the streets of Prague, on a specific corner, is Brundibar, who is an organ grinder. Mean. In Czech, Brundibar means bee, like a bee sting. And he's taken over the whole place, and he sings, and people throw money in his hat, and the kids say, well, anybody can do that. So they stand on the other corner and they sing a dreadful song. Everyone just ignores them and they wonder why they can't do this. And they stay all night in the street by themselves and a cat and a bird and a dog come to their assistance and say, look, let's pull this together because the two of you can't do this by yourselves. Let's get all the kids in town. And in the morning there's this beautiful music. As children wake up and they're getting ready to go to school and comb their hair and wash dishes and such. And the animals convince them to come and help these kids. So they all come to the town square, 300 of them. And they say to Brundibar, we want to sing and we don't care about money. We just want to sing. And Brundibar says, no, get the hell out of here. And then the townspeople say, oh, let the kids do it. And they sing a lullaby, which is like extraordinary to hear it. And people are captivated, and they fill their milk can with coins. They've made it. They have enough money now. But Brundibar sneaks in, grabs the can, rushes off and steals their money, and the whole town chases Brundibar, and they catch him, and they beat him up, and the kids get their money back and buy the milk, come home triumphant, and save their mama. And that's the story.
But there's an epilogue to the story. There's a little poem at the end. Could you read that
sure,
for us?
Sure.
And just, you know, reminder, this is written while Hitler is coming to power.
Exactly. And the fact that it is impossible for me to doubt that the children knew what their fate was. Imagine standing up on the stage and singing about brotherhood, and if we all hang together, we're going to succeed, and the bully will not. And knowing that as soon as this audience left, kaput, their lives are finished. I can't even grasp that now. I've been studying, working on this for over 3 years. Okay, so we're just turning the page on the big happy ending where everything is wonderful and safe and mommy is alive. And then there's a little coda at the end, which was written by Tony, basically. It's not in the opera. And it says, this is Brundibar talking, "They believe they've won the fight. They believe I'm gone. Not quite. Nothing ever works out neatly. Bullies don't give up completely. One departs, the next appears, and we shall meet again, my dears. Though I go, I won't go far. I'll be back. Love, Brundibar."
Yeah, it's kind of chilling.
Yeah, kind of chilling.
Chilling epilogue.
Yeah.
So Tony Kushner wrote that for the book.
He wrote that, yeah.
Marie Sendak from a 2003 interview. Let's jump back and hear a little more from his earlier conversation on Fresh Air.
One of the great controversies about your book, is, you know, in the night kitchen, when the character Mickey lands in the batter, he's naked, and mm-hmm. there's this, like, little boy penis that he has, right?
Yeah.
And there were libraries that wouldn't carry the book or would draw little diapers over him, all kinds of silly things like that. I mean, this was not a sexual image. It was just a naked boy image.
Correct.
Right?
I mean, it would have been strange had he not had a penis.
Right.
But no one has ever discussed that problem.
Right.
The astonishing and infuriating business on that book was that was, it's one of my favorite works, and it's a rather complex work. And to have it all reduced, so to speak, to a child's penis is embarrassing and silly. And the fact that anyone could carry on about such an issue, does not speak well for our culture.
Well, here's what I'm wondering. Now, that book was not about Mickey as a sexual boy or anything, but I think a lot of kids do have sexual feelings, maybe just a little bit older than Mickey. And I was wondering if you ever thought about putting sexual feelings into a children's book, or if that would seem like much too far out.
Well, I have to correct something you say, or at least I don't agree with something you just said, which
okay.
is that he, little boy, in the night kitchen, does not have sexual feelings. Of course he does. We have them immediately on arrival. There's nothing, in a word, that you can do that is not sexual, so far as I'm concerned. And the creative act is composed of its sexual component. And I don't mean by saying sexual, that is vivid, livid sex. I mean the component of sexuality, sensuality, eroticism is part of everything. And it's what blesses our life. And instead of seeing it in an accusatory way, and I don't mean you, I mean culture in general, or blameworthy way, rather see it for the beautiful thing that it is.
I remember I interviewed you, 8 years ago or something. Something that you said really stuck with me. You were talking about the monsters and where the wild things are, and you were saying that when you were young, the monsters were just adults. There were people with, like, moles on their faces and hairs growing out of their noses.
Yeah.
Old
relatives, actually.
Yeah, old relatives, exactly. Relative, exactly.
Yeah.
And that really struck a chord. And then I started thinking, well, I'm one of those people now. I mean, I don't know if I actually have hair growing out of my nose, but you know, I have some of those things that I'm sure kind of like scare kids.
Oh, sure.
And do you have your sense of yourself as that too?
Of like, course.
You know, a monster to some kids?
Of course I am. I see it in their eyes. When I'm autographing books, which I don't like to do much anymore, and children are shoved at me.
Yeah.
They have no idea why they're on the line. They'd much rather be in the bathroom. And they're standing online, and they're being told something which is so frightening and confusing, which is being told by mom or dad. This is the man you like so much, honey. This is the man who did your favorite book. And they clutch their book even closer, because that really means he's going to take it away. Because if this is the man's favorite book, then he's going to take your book. And the look of alarm and the tears, and they stare at me like pure hatred. Who is this elderly, short man sitting behind the desk who's going to take their book away? Then on top of that, the parent says, "Now give him your book, honey. He wants to write something in it." Well, there they've been told, don't write in the book. Okay? Why then is it all right for a perfect stranger to write in their book? It's horrible for them. And I become horrible. Unwittingly, I make children cry.
They cry when they
meet me because they don't know what I'm doing. That's why I've stopped autographing for the most part.
Uh-huh.
For that very, very reason, it's such a paradox that I, who adore them and I'm interested in their welfare, should become their enemy. It's only because it's set up that way. If I'm to visit a school, they're all warned, threatened, and browbeaten for 3 days before I get there. Now I want all of you to be nice, and you must raise your hand, and I want everyone to go to the bathroom before Mr. Sendak comes. I mean, their lives are ruined. So why should I be the person who does that to them?
Oh.
Maria Sendak speaking to Terry Gross in 1993. New York's 92nd Street Y celebrates his 80th birthday this Monday. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.